So we are continuing our two-quarter study, survey study of the Old Testament. And tonight, I've got good news for you. The good news is the Jews are back where they belong, baby. They're back in the homeland. We have followed these Jews since the beginning. And at times, we have been just as frustrated with them as presumably God was, although I'm sure he's far, far more frustrated with them than we could ever be, being that he's blessed them with all the things that they kind of took for granted. We have followed them as they walked with God and then walked far away from God and then ran away from God. And we've recently completed the portion of Israel's history where they went into captivity. This was the ultimate punishment from God. This promised land really has been the focus of the Old Testament since early on. I'm talking Genesis chapter 12 days. And the children of Israel, God's people, long last entered that promised land. They were significantly delayed because of their disobedience. We've talked about that. And then their subsequent wandering in the wilderness. But that water under the bridge, they were allowed to go into the promised land at long last, where they didn't exactly do everything that God told them to do, as you expect if you know anything about these Jews here. They didn't fully come on board and obey God. They left some of the dwellers in the land that God gave them. This was against God's instruction to them. The people soon went through a terrible cycle of on again, off again in their relationship with God. We described this to you and we said a word or two about the book of Judges, how Israel in that book went through a phase of falling out of with God, and then God would allow foreign forces to press them. Then every time these Jews would get religion, come back to God, and the sweet undertone of the book of Judges, even though it is full of so much rebellion and disobedience and interest in God, the sweet undertone of the book of Judges is every time they came back to him, he was there. God could go anywhere. When they came back to him, he was there. He sent them a judge, which is what the Bible calls it, or a savior, which we've done that word and understood could be an alternate meaning for it. That wasn't good enough for God's people for very long. They wanted what? They wanted a king. One of the reasons why they wanted a king was why? Be like everybody else. Peer pressure is a real thing. It's not just an elementary school thing. It's a real thing for everybody. Even congregations. Go ahead. Yeah. There was corruption in India. There was corruption in the priesthood. The apparent leaders ought to be leaders of God's people were not exactly doing what they were supposed to be doing. Nice point there. If they were doing what they were supposed to be doing, I still reckon the Jews would have wanted a king. Because, Sam, you remember, and we all remember, you reminded us of this, in fact, many times, Sam, that Samuel petitioned the people on God's behalf. Please don't do this thing. Don't do this thing. It's terrible. And remember, he even told them what a king's going to do to you. You're going to have to pay taxes. You're going to be his subjects. And the people didn't care. They wanted a king anyway. They wanted a king because everybody else around them had a king, and that was that. So, go ahead. Yeah, he warned them. Indeed. Right. Not a foreign, yeah. Good, good. First you're late, you reminded us. Yes, indeed. Indeed. So the kingdom was born, right? Beginning with Saul. And then David, then Solomon. And the kingdom soon split after 100-ish years. And the northern kingdom was formed. It consists of how many tribes of the 12 tribes of Israel? How many? 10 tribes from the northern kingdom. Their first king was Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. That's what the Bible calls him, a whole bunch. How'd you like to be known for that? Your name, Jeroboam, it's almost like it's a part of his name, the son of Nebat who caused Israel to sin. And you'll be amazed if you do a phrase search for that phrase, how many times it appears. There is a whole lot of discredit. There's a whole lot of blame placed on Jeroboam. Everybody's an accountable soul. No one makes you do what's wrong. But Jeroboam certainly did put the people on a path that led them away from God. He's responsible for that. They're responsible following that. So there's plenty of blame to go around. Jeroboam did them no favors. Two tribes that leaves, making up the southern kingdom. And this is the period of Israel's history that is fascinating if you like to geek out on some of the details. Each kingdom had about 20 kings. I think I had 19. One had 20 or one. I don't know. Maybe at one time I used to know them. I don't know anymore. But they had roughly the same amount of kings. And they just continued on a path that led them away from God. The northern kingdom didn't have a single good king in it. And the southern kingdom squeaked out a few good kings, but by and large their kings were corrupt and godly as well. And so around about this time, God has got enough. He's been patient with these people forever, it seems. And now God's patience has run out. Be careful when God's patience runs out. It's run out, and God, in a mighty symbolic act, is going to take the people out of the land that He gave them as a promise. Their entrance into the promised land was so glorious and symbolic because they were finally able to inhabit the land that God gave them, God promised to give them. A land truly that flowed of milk and honey, as even some of their own spies brought back the report of. So it is equally symbolic of God's displeasure with these people that He's now going to give that promised land to somebody else. The first somebody else He gives it to is the Assyrians, who about the year 721 come and capture the northern kingdom of Israel. And physically, literally remove the Jews from that land and kind of embed them into some of their other territories that the Assyrians control. The same thing is going to happen to the southern kingdom about 110-ish years later, when in 606 BC, not the Assyrians this time, but the Babylonians are going to come and take over the Assyrian territory, including the northern kingdom of Israel, and then expand southward and take the southern kingdom as well. So now, all of God's people, along with many other peoples of the earth, but all of God's people are removed from the promised land, and it belongs to somebody else. And it stays that way for a while. It stayed that way for a while. And we noted a couple of weeks ago, if I'm not mistaken, that the books of Daniel and the books of Ezekiel, Daniel and Ezekiel give us a very interesting glimpse into life as a Babylonian captive. Not necessarily typical life, because Daniel's experience was atypical. Daniel was favored greatly by the king. Through Daniel's eyes and through Daniel's inspired words, we're getting a sense of what the Jews lived through under this Babylonian captivity. Things that we read in the book of Daniel, like Nebuchadnezzar's demand for his golden image to be worshipped. I mean, this applied to people who were favored by the king and not. This was, everybody had to do this. The decree to worship the king or be thrown into the lion's den. This was day in the life, Babylonian captivity kind of stuff. And we are now at the point where the Jews are let go. They're released from this captivity, not by a Babylonian king, but by a Persian king named Cyrus. Isaiah, in a bit of remarkable, fabulous Bible prophecy that is a proof of the Bible's inspiration, Isaiah names Cyrus and says, before it ever happened, that Cyrus was going to free the Jews. And we saw that last week as we peeked into the book of Ezra. And rushed up on Ezra's ministry. In the first year of Cyrus, the Jews were let go. Ezra chapter 1 lets us know all of the things that were taken from the temple that Nebuchadnezzar ransacked, all those golden cups and so on and so forth. Cyrus released them, let them go. Cyrus even, dig into Ezra chapter 5, Ezra chapter 6, you will find that Cyrus allowed Jews to rebuild their temple. We mentioned last week, as the Jews are let go, as the Jews are allowed to come back to the promised land, they have some things they need to do. Number one, they need to, in particular order, number one, they build a wall. The book of Nehemiah famously kind of gives us a peek into their wall-building efforts. Number two, they needed to build a temple. Ezra kind of gives us a peek into their temple-building efforts. But what we focused on last week and said was more important than a wall or a temple was the relationship that they needed to rebuild. The relationship with God that they needed to rebuild. And we looked at Ezra chapter 9, Ezra chapter 10, and found Ezra, the priest there, giving these people some very, very plain words from the Lord that they needed to obey. Things that hit home to them pretty close. Things even about their marriage that they needed to actively take care of in order to get back right with God. Well, as we look down at the book of Haggai tonight, a little bit of time has passed. And the Jews have been back in their promised land for a while. Not a long while, but 6, 8, 10 years. They've been back in their homeland for a bit. And I'm sad to report to you tonight that they're kind of slipping, these Jews are. The last three books of the Old Testament, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, these are prophets to the Jews after their return. We've been introduced to some of these prophets, and we've seen that some of them prophesied before the exile. Some prophesied during the exile. Here, we're getting our look at the last prophets, those who worked after the exile after the return. Second year of Darius. Darius was a Mede king. We mentioned last week that the Persians and the Medes put an end to all the fighting and formed kind of an interesting little alliance and kind of co-reigned, you know. So the history of the world history at this time kind of blends. You know, some of the Persians, some of the Medes, one didn't necessarily kind of been eaten to the other. They both kind of coexisted, but in an amicable way. I was describing it to someone this past week, kind of like a a NATO alliance or a North American type alliance, a European Union kind of thing. So some good, some bad, I'm sure. But as we read about God's people during this phase of world history, we won't be surprised to read the name Persian kings sprinkled in with the names of Median kings. And here is one of those latter kings, Darius. He allows the same kind of thing that Cyrus allowed. Cyrus got this thing started, and Darius is or Darius is pronounced different ways, allowed it to remain. So you just see, we won't bog down on this too much, but you see how Haggai chapter 1 verse 1 begins, second year of Darius or Darius. Zechariah chapter 1 verse 1, second year of Darius or Darius. Zechariah is a bit of a longer book. Zechariah, rather, is a bit of a longer book. And then Malachi comes and doesn't give us the same kind of time stamp, but it's talking to God's people in roughly the same frame of time. Chapter 1, verse 2. Haggai chapter 1, verse 2. Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, this people says, the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Uh-oh. We mention kind of in quick passing a rather significant thing that happened as they turned. The temple was rebuilt. And we read in Ezra chapter 5, Ezra chapter 6, a dedication ceremony of sorts to this temple. Well, one does not go from no temple to fully up and operational temple overnight, you know. So this was a process, obviously. And here in Haggai's book, Haggai is going to circle back to the people's treatment of the under-construction temple. So the people are saying that they don't have enough time to focus on the temple, right? That's Haggai chapter 1, verse 2. And as I'm sure you can anticipate, God has some thoughts about this. The people are saying, we just can't get around to building that temple thing. What do you reckon the people are busy doing instead of building the temple? Say it again. They're busy building their own houses and signing their kids up for softball and looking for a job and getting to know the neighbors. And they're busy doing a plethora of things. I mean, they're busy doing the same type of things that folks are busy doing today, you know. And meanwhile, they're saying, you know, we just hadn't found the time to get around to fixing up the temple stuff. Meanwhile, look at it in chapter 1, verse 4. Is it time for you, or from the King James Version tonight, Is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in sealed houses? Back in these primitive times, construction being a little different than it is now makes it maybe a tad tougher to follow. But here's what you're getting from Haggai chapter 4. They were doing improvement projects to their houses. They're sealed houses. You know, they were waterproofing their houses, putting the gutters up, making sure the rain, you know, didn't leak in on them. They were really kind of pulling out all the stops, getting comfortable back in their home. Meanwhile, the Lord's house, according to Haggai 1:4, lies in waste. It had been started, this temple project had been started. But Haggai's report to us, chapter 1, verse 4, is it was a little rough. You know, we needed to spend some more time working on this temple rather than focus on, you know, your amenities and your luxuries. Now, things are different now than then, but at the root of the problem is, you know, something that really has never not existed. Right? This is a matter of priorities, wouldn't you say? Then it's fair to point out that the temple was a holy place. It represented God's presence for the people, so on and so forth. Today, church buildings are not that. Church buildings are not holy. These are just buildings that we love, that we should appreciate, that help us facilitate an act of worship, facilitate a command of God, which is to come together and worship. So it's not a one-to-one comparison. I want to be very clear on that, and I'll probably say that at least a time or two before class ends. It's not a one-to-one comparison. But, you know, the priorities that these people showed, the lack of proper priorities, that definitely compares to us today. You know, we've got lots of people running around saying they can't do this and they can't do that, can't come to church, can't help out in the Bible classes, can't help out for the cleanup days or the renovations that need to be done. They can't do those sorts of things. Meanwhile, you know, they're living pretty comfortable lives themselves. One of the things about Christianity is it should be a life of sacrifice. And we've got to really challenge ourselves at times to look around and see what is it that I'm doing with less of because of my faith? What is it that I'm really sacrificing? We live in a rich land. You might not think of yourself as being rich, but man, and if you travel around the world, if you see people, you will absolutely be convinced so quickly of your riches. And it's not bad to have nice things. Not anything wrong with these folks having a nice house. Nothing wrong with putting a pool in the backyard. Nothing wrong with getting a new roof and gutters and some nice landscaping. Nothing wrong with that. Unless that becomes your drive, and that steals away motivation and resources that you otherwise could have been given to God. Don't get it twisted. Sometimes when we talk about having nice things, or we talk about money, which is kind of a roundabout thing that's being brought up here in Haggai chapter 1, we get the impression that we should be kind of impoverished. I mean, there's this that it's wrong to have nice things. We should feel guilty if we've got nice stuff. No, that's certainly not what I'm trying to do tonight. But we should certainly be very, very objective about what we are prioritizing in life. Thoughts, comments, questions. That's a pretty general. Point there. Do you have anything you want to put on that? Yes, sir, Sam. Yeah. That's right. That's right. Sure. The sacrifices. In a much more concrete way, in a much more for real way, the temple and the tabernacle, as you saw, Sam, represented God's presence among the people. Yeah, to them. Now, today, God is present with us. There is a temple of God today. It's not the church building. What is it? Our body. But what is it? What is it beyond that? The church. The church today is God's house. And the church is not the church building, right? So I'm asking you to do a couple of kind of abstract things here. We're taking a look at a physical temple in the Old Testament and seeing their neglect of it. And we're using that to learn some modern day lessons about how we ought not neglect the Lord's house today, which is the church, not the church building, although sometimes our priorities are seen tangibly in a church building, right? So there's some tie-in, although I'm not going for complete apples-to-apples comparison. Yes, ma'am. Acts of service for one another, ma'am. Yes. Consider your ways. Chapter 1, verse 5 says, shortly after getting back everything that they'd lost, it is distressing to see these people doing the same thing that they were doing to anger God in the first place, right? If anybody would be on fire for the Lord in a good way, you'd expect it to be these people. Wouldn't you? I mean, I would. They had just been punished. I mean, the best time for my kids to listen to me is right after they've been punished. Because there's a reminder of, Mom and Dad mean business, and they tell me to do something. I was just punished for not doing it, so I better really make sure I do it this time. God's children had just been punished, and you would expect their behavior to be so much better, but it's not. They're still very selfish and self-absorbed, and so you have this drumbeat. Chapter 1, verse 5, consider your ways. Chapter 1, 7, consider your ways. In the remainder of Haggai, chapter 1, the prophet Haggai is going to tell the people, God is still ultimately in charge of things here. You can neglect God all you want and spend all of your time planting your crops and your vineyards and, you know, taking care of yourself and pampering yourself, you can spend all your time doing that. And who's still in charge? God is. Look at chapter 1, verse 11. I call a drought upon the land. So here's what went. The people were neglecting God. and they were planning bigger and bigger farms for themselves, right? And God says, oh yeah? An idol is not just a piece of wood that's a statue. An idol is not just a bit of stone that's a statue. An idol is, as being here, anything that you put ahead of God. Could be your children's activity. It is, a lot of times today, your children's activities. It could be that extra car that you want to buy, that extra, that bigger house that you work for, and in doing that, you kind of take your eyes off of the Lord, and maybe you give less, maybe you work more, and you do less, so that you can afford bigger and newer and nicer. And these become your goal and your God if you're not careful. You can do that all you want. Every day of your blessed life, you can do that. And God's telling you, I'm still in charge. Hand here. Yes, sir, Mr. Jeremy. Oh, boy. As we fail in our prioritization, how much of that should be publicly repented of? That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know so much about the public aspect of that repentance. I guess if you're a guy who goes on and on, I have in my decades of preaching, I have known of a guy who went forward and asked for prayers of forgiveness, and he specifically cited he took on extra overtime so that the family could, I don't know, go on vacation or do something, get the pool, I don't know. He felt in his case that it had reached a level where it was that public. I don't think it always reaches that case. I don't know if I think it often reaches that case. But it's a good heart-searching question, right? Michael, I saw your hand. Did you have something on that point? Yeah. Sure. And if you're the guy who's like, you know, if you kind of put that out there. I'm doing this, I'm working this extra, I'm taking on this so that I can take the family to wherever. Then maybe it's more public than less public. Wes, yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right, you know, it has shades of that foolish farmer, doesn't it? Who looked around and saw barns full of stuff and barns bursting at the seams, and then he said, "We're gotta knock down these barns and build bigger barns." Right, and he was told, "Whose are these things? Not yours, because your life is not even yours. It's a vapor." That it appears for a little while in the man's way. That's a game-changing thing. Go, real quick, yes, sir. Yeah. Excellent. We will pick up here. Yeah. Luke chapter 4. Yes. We will pick up here next time. Thanks a lot, y'all. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Augusta Road Church of Christ. Located in Greenville, South Carolina, the Augusta Road Congregation worships God in spirit and in truth in a friendly and loving environment. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter by searching for Augusta Road COC. And if you're ever in Greenville, South Carolina, we would love for you to come by for a visit.